I'm very interested how the dress can give information. I think the dress is a way of being naked nowadays, because the dress, no, the garment, in fact, the garments say many things about ourselves, more than being naked.
Today's guest is Alicia Frames. Alicia is a Spanish conceptual artist living in Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and her work is very much driven by our all connection and our social engagement. And she is doing a performance at the gallery, which is residing in paintings. There's a diamond-shaped sculpture made of stainless steel, and all gallery visitors can leave their fears in that sculpture. And Alicia is then taking these fears out during the gallery hours while visitors are in the space, and is painting these fears on special canvases she has created, and is also in dialogue with the visitors. But long story short, let's welcome Alicia Frames.
Thank you.
Alicia, what I'm very interested in is, we all as professional participants in the art world, what was your first contact to art? When did it occur, the possibility to become a professional artist?
Yes, I like very much this question, because in fact, my father told me when I was 6 years old, he asked me, what do I want to become when I am adult? And I say, I want to become a famous painter, because he was a very cultivated man. He loves art, and his best friend was a painter. And my grandfather was a painter. And, you know, we were very connected to art. He thought, okay, this is something that I have to really follow. It's the wish of my daughter. Then already when I was 11 years old, I was in a studio of an artist from my neighborhood. And it was fantastic that I could work already in a, you know, with a professional artist. And I was her pupil, no?
Was a female artist.
Yes, female artist. And yes, from Barcelona.
What was your father doing?
He had a company, and he worked for architects to make pieces of concrete. He had this business because his family don't wanted that he became, you know, like a musician or an artist or something, because we came from a family of, men that works had enterprise. They all wanted to become painters, and they were painters in the free time. Yes, mm-hmm. Therefore, so they were frustrated.
Okay, so people. He was an amateur painter when he had time.
My grandfather, he was the painter, and my father, in fact, he was a frustrated musician, a conductor. Uh-huh. He was all the time conducting, and he loved to do that. And he loved he loved art, and he was all the time reading. And of course, in his times, when he was young, he couldn't decide to be an artist or to become a musician or a conductor. He had to follow, this mind of, to be an entrepreneur.
But he encouraged you in your wish to proceed.
Yes. Therefore, we had all family against us. We did together that I can become an artist.
So, and then you somehow were like very young, interning or helping in a painter's studio.
Yes.
And she was a professional artist living from her art.
Yes, of course, was, world famous in Barcelona. I think was the best that happened in my life is that I was already in a studio, in an artist's studio from I was very, very small. I mean, it was no academy of art, was a studio, an artist's studio.
Your topics in your practice are very connected to fashion, feminism, minorities, and maybe social structures. But also you work with somehow social structures in a physical way of architecture, pavilions, or like rooms where people interact. How did you enter that space? So I understand also when you started to study art, you started with painting?
Yes. In my time, we started with painting, and my uncle was the dean of fine arts in Barcelona. Therefore, and he was a painter. He's a painter. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we were all following as yeah, like painting. But I had the lucky to go to Paris with a grant, and then I discovered performances and installations, and I was with Sophie Kahl, with Marina Abramovic, with Chen Zhen, Polstansky, and then, yeah, I thought, in fact, that painting was good. Of course, all my life was good because I discovered many things, but I discovered that, in fact, I really liked space and people. And how I can combine space and people. And for me, I am really attached to the 90s with aesthetic, relational aesthetics. Of course, all subjects that you said belongs to my work. But I will say too that one of my aims is that art brings people together.
So when we go back to Barcelona, you started studying in Barcelona, more traditional in the art academy, learning painting, nude painting, things like this. And then the move to Paris was important, I understand. So how old were you when you moved to Paris?
I went with 21. 21.
And there, somehow, another possibility of practice opened up.
Yes, yes. And was really good that I could have the Institute of Haute Etude of Art Plastics from Daniel Buren.
Yes.
I was in his master for 1 year, and then we became friends. And I think Daniel Buren was, for me, very important.
When would you say did your, because I think in the practice of an artist, it takes some time before you really understand what's your language and what's the route to go, and then to get more precise in the articulating practice. What do you think was your first serious work which you consider an Alicia Farmes practice?
I have a work that I did for in Rijks Academy in Amsterdam that I think was a big success. It was a work that was called Arte Habitable, the art of living. You have to imagine that was in 95, was a very long time ago. In this moment was very good for me because I decided I really will do what I want as an artist. And then I said to the teachers, well, they were not called teachers, but yeah, the tutors of Rijks Academy, that in this moment was Dan Graham, Herman Pitsch. Herman Pitsch really helped me all my life, that I said, you know, I really want to live for 3 months with 5 artists that I don't know in a house and record all our lives inside the house and don't go out for 3 months. And just to study if we can make art from our daily life and to see what really we need as artists for our life, no? But was an experiment, and I said to them, I don't mind if after 3 months we don't have any artwork, but I would love really much to do this experiment. And yeah, it was very nice because thanks to Herman Pitsch and Dan Graham, they rent me a house and I could put other 4 artists living with me, and we had some budget. We couldn't go out of the house. And of course, after 1 month, one person left the house, and after 2 months was enough for us. But we made some artworks and some performances. And after 2 months, we invite people to see our research, our experiments. And of course, this work was in all newspapers because, of course, we were in this house for 2 months and all neighbors know us, that we were a kind of astronauts living in this house. And I got a fantastic prize from Stedelijk Museum as the best artist of the year for this experiment. And of course, this work is related to the Big Brother that became so famous.
But you were after. Much ahead of it, right?
Yes, yeah, I was in 95. And of course, Big Brother was made 3 years after from Mr. Moll that lives in Netherlands. Therefore, of course, I think we were all connected. And of course, one of the brothers of Mr. Moll became my big mecenas. He helped me many years to develop my work. with production of my work. Therefore, this work was my biggest work, or the beginning of my career as a conceptual artist. And I think I always make works that is always very about innovation.
There's one work about from the same time, a little bit later. It's titled Minibar, which you did in Berlin. And if I understand right, it was a structure only accessible to women. And maybe you can tell us about it.
Yes, because of course, after I wanted to be able to make rooms, because in this case, like Arte Habitable, the art of living, the work I talked before from 95, was attached to a house. I thought, how I can make rooms that I can bring to other places. Then I did it minibar. Minibar is a room, 3 meters by 3 meters by 3, that is only for women to have pleasure. This work came because I was living in Amsterdam. I'm still living in Amsterdam. And I thought, wow, you know, these places where men can have pleasure and it's not a place, even now, because I am still researching, it's not a place in Amsterdam where women can have pleasure. And then I make this minibar, this place where women can have pleasure. But of course, I had to, because I'm really a researcher. You know, I'm somebody that researches before I make a work, and I interview 100 women, what they are missing in their sexual life. And these 100 women, the most of them, they told me what they miss was a hugs, a nice conversation, a massage, tenderness, you know, not really the act of making love, but the other components.
The care.
Yes. And then in this room, I had some comforters. There were some men that they comfort this woman. And it was a big success. Now it's a Migros Museum bought this work many years ago and belongs to their collection.
It's also interesting to think of, I mean, it's like comfort women turned around to comfort men. And it's, I think it's always very important to think of the time you did these pieces. In another piece you did titled Contemplation Room, which I think is also pretty unimaginable today. So there you provided a space in the museum where it was possible to smoke.
Yes, this is one of my favorite works. It's called Contemplation Room, thanks to Rein Wolf, that in this moment was the director of Migros Museum. We could make this work that again is very conceptual work, because there are rooms of 3 meters by 3 meters by 3 meters. This one is made all in glass, and inside you have a very big asterisk where people can smoke. And what is very nice is now Migros Museum is showing this work, I think right now, and many museums ask this work as for loan, you know, because the work is prepared, is especially prepared that you can smoke and you can enjoy art while you are smoking.
And looking at this work today, what's your perspective on it now? Because I think smoking is such a different, I think also Uncavara, he created a space in the museum in Frankfurt because he was a very heavy smoker, where you could be in his space and smoke. But I think today smoking is really like cancelled, I would say.
Yes, but I must say I am like Uncavara. I was a heavy smoker until I couldn't smoke anymore. I think, of course, that now many people can be against of this room, but I still think many people smoke. It's no problem. It's like we could have a room of people drinking too. I mean, yeah, people drink and smoke.
So I mean, you create spaces or provide structure repeatedly in your work. You did one project where you turned billboards into houses. So yeah, maybe you can explain. If I understand right, there were billboards put in a way together to create shelter for homeless people.
Yes, yes. This work, Billboard House, Amsterdam for me is a place I become inspired many times. And I thought that it's not like here, like in Berlin. In Amsterdam, it's very, very difficult to find a place to live. It's very expensive. Then I thought maybe we can combine these people that, yeah, they cannot afford a house with advertisement, with these billboards, and make a house with billboards. This was the beginning of something, because after that I had many people, they call me to say they would like it to do it in real. Therefore, the billboard house was the beginning of another way of living, where people can maybe live near a billboard or with billboards, or, you know, to have some kind of warm place.
So you somehow try to provide almost like utopian concepts on how the our social togetherness could be changed.
Yes. I decided many years ago, when I was a student, in fact, that therefore I stopped painting and I become maybe social artist, that I work with presentation, not with representation. Therefore, for me, it's very important that I work with the real. Therefore, it's always how to make possibilities for people to live together, or possibilities how we can live better how together.
What I like is that you still bring it back to the representative art object somehow, because you did this project Screaming Room, where you had a performance, people joined the space, and then they screamed into or created a 3D cup based on the screaming. Maybe you can explain.
Yeah, a screaming room is a very special room, because in fact, with this room, I win a prize as the best innovation of the year, because I use the voice, the scream in this case, of people to make an object of 3D object. This room.
How does it work? Like, how do
yes.
you?
How it works is that this room, in fact, was made for a bank. That the maybe you remember that many years ago was a big crisis, and banks had a lot of struggles. Then one of my best collectors, Rabobank, asked me if I can do something for the workers. Then I say, yeah, I would love to make a room where people can scream, because they are so tense and they have so, you know, so difficult times altogether. Then in the bank, I make this room where people can scream. But I read Einstein, and Einstein, what I love of him is he said the energy, in this case, the bad energy was the screaming, no, can never disappear, but can be transformed. You know, then I thought I have to study as an artist how I can transform this energy in something good.
Like an anxiety gets out of the scream and resides in a cup.
Yes.
But why a cup?
Yes.
Why not a...
Ah, the cup is because, in fact, this scream when a person enters in the room, screams, and then this scream goes to a computer that nobody see, and this computer is connected to a 3D printer, and the 3D printer is making a cup that is unique, because the scream is always unique. The voice of human beings is unique. Therefore, the design of your cup is unique. And I decided a tea cup, because I thought in the bank, like here in the gallery, many people, the moment that people are together is in the moment they take a coffee or they have a tea. Therefore,
yeah,
I thought...
And they bring their own cup, no? It's like an identity.
Yes.
It's like somehow almost like fashion, or, you know, it's a possibility of to express your personality.
Yes,
yeah.
It's exactly. Yeah. It's this. And I love it that people can join with their own cup of tea, that everybody has different cup of tea. We can even clean in the dishwasher. Therefore, it was really prepared for the bank life.
Mm-hmm.
No?
And you also work about people's anxieties and fears in the exhibition we are working on right now. So the visitors are invited to leave their fear at the entrance, and then you transform them. Maybe you can tell us, is it from the same Einstein-influenced thought of how bad energy can transform, or where this is coming from?
Yes, I think how to transform energy, and I think is one of the tasks as an artist, as a performer. I'm working with the fears of people in the way that how I can transform this fear. Not when people come and write their fear and put in the diamond in a sculpture that is a kind of a container of the fears. How I can transform this fear in something visible, in something that can help other people again, you know, to start a kind of dialogue about our own fears. Therefore, what I go to do is to write the fears in some surfaces that I prepare in different colors, materials, how I can make a tool to bring people together. Therefore, I would like to stay in the gallery, you know, for 1 month with this performance or this being there and transforming the fears in something else where people can feel more connected.
So you're going to actually sit in the space and work on the canvases in presence of the visitors?
Yes, yes.
And they, where do they leave their fears?
They leave the fears in a big sculpture, interactive sculpture made in stainless steel that is a kind of container. Because I think, of course, people can leave the fears there and it's something between the person and the sculpture.
But so then, it's anonymously you leave your... and then you don't know if your fear will make it to the painting, right?
No, because I would like to be there and talk to the people and see if maybe we have a dialogue about fears.
And you choose fear. It's kind of heavy to let go of fears, but to it's also super intimate. Actually, are fears more intimate than joy? What do you think?
Yes. Fear, in fact, is the motor of many art practices. And I think fear is the motor of many change in life. We overcome fears. But the first feeling we have is fear. Fear is a kind of crisis, or is a kind of awareness of crisis. Therefore, anyhow, I think in the moments, unfortunately, that we are living as human beings, we are surrounded by fears. You know, therefore, I would like it to work in this as a subject that nowadays feeling more fears than before, unfortunately.
And are you surprised by the fears you receive?
Yes.
Yeah.
I must say, of course, there are 5 fears. They are always there, like it's loneliness, being old, or to lose everything. Of course, some fears are standard.
Yeah.
But I think, for example, one fear that I think is surprised me, for example, and it belongs really much to the 21st century, is people are fear to do nothing. We are so like machines, you know, like working and doing so many things.
To have no purpose or to do nothing?
To do nothing.
Yeah.
That people are afraid that they are confronted to do nothing, for example, to do nothing. And I think...
That's probably something, as an artist, you can't really relate to, no? Because you create unasked.
Yes. Yes. Another fear, for example, fear of ourselves, I think is interesting. Fears change, depends of the country. I think this is very interesting. Therefore, I really want to make an archive of fears. I have already like 1,000 something. And of course, my PhD is about fears.
Ah, yeah. So you...
Yes, I'm almost there finishing my PhD about fear. Fear as the motor of artistic practices, in fact, in all history of art.
And you do this parallel to your visual art practice?
Yes, yeah. Yes. I do, because I really think that an artist has always to be studying.
And then there's another work of yours, which is probably also connected to fears. It's called Life Dress, where you created a performance, or actually this is what I refer to at the beginning. It's like between fashion, feminism, because there are sculptural objects which can be worn, and there are dresses made of airbag fabrics, which are sort of sexual harassment preventions. Maybe you can tell us how you got to it and how it actually functions. Also, I would say another utopian concept against a dystopian world.
Yes, yes. In fact, I'm very interested how the dress can give information. I think the dress is a way of being naked nowadays because the dress, no, the garment, in fact, the garment say many things about ourselves more than being naked. Therefore, I really believe strongly about the function of the garments to inform about our daily life. Therefore, Life Dress is a collection of dresses made again for Rabobank, for the bank. Was a moment where they wanted to address harassment of women in places of work, in working places. Then I say to them, maybe we can work together about making these dresses. And of course, I like it very much, the airbag fabric, because airbag fabric is something that you never see, only when you have an accident.
Therefore, oh, yeah, because it's hidden in the car.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Therefore, in fact, nobody, I hope nobody see in their lives airbag fabric. But yeah, through my work, you can see how it looks like. It's the copyright is from Japan. And then I talk to the enterprise in Japan. I say, I wanted to make these dresses. And they say, it's not possible for dresses. I say, okay, for sculptures. And in fact, there are dresses that together with Rabobank and they dress. I mean, even the people from the board to people from, you know, many, many girls from the bank, they are in the film and they dress. And they comment about this problem in some offices or in some working places.
And the airbags, you use the material as a metaphor because they're not actually functioning, right? They're not blowing up.
Yes, yes, they blow up.
Ah, okay.
Yes, yes. I make a motor. They are going with motors and they can blow. These garments, they can blow. And yes, they can blow and they can function. But of course, in the same time, it's a kind of
metaphor, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Similar to another very beautiful metaphor you did is this walking glass ceiling. I think there's this term to the glass ceiling. There's a great podcast actually also called Glass Ceiling. And I think it's mainly used for women reaching the glass ceiling, which means sort of they are blocked to grow to a certain level because of the patriarchic structures or the legacy, how society is structured and also only changing slowly.
Yes, unfortunately, the glass ceiling is an expression that was made 40 years ago and still exists. I must say that many women bought this work.
Yeah.
Women that they are very powerful, I think they felt... felt connected to their sculptures, and there are sculptures that they represent women in the story of art, and we can and they have this glass ceiling in their head.
Maybe you can explain. So because it's almost like a passstück sort of wearable sculpture, no? So because it's a glass ceiling you put on your head.
Yes.
Yeah. So how do you carry it? How can we imagine the sculpture?
Yeah. I have a small sculptures that they are with the representation of women in history. But first of all, what I did is a performance with 8 women that they are walking with this glass ceiling that is 80 kilos weight. And it's one plate of glass, and they are walking with this glass.
Almost like a
together.
Ceremony, right? I mean, it's like, yes. It's so you have like 8 women, almost like a coffin. The image reminds a bit of a, how you call it, when you have a funeral and you have men wearing a coffin on their shoulder. They are in a group and having this 2x3 meter glass window carried on top of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a kind of ritual.
Like a procession,
Yes, procession. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. And of course, first time I did it in Spain and I wanted to do it in the street was difficult. But it looks, because these girls, they look very much like office girls, like, women that they go to work. But at the same time, you see them walking with this glass ceiling, and looks like a kind of modern conceptual procession. But it's true. I mean, if you talk more and more with powerful women, they say it's true. We have this glass ceiling.
It's interesting that this term glass ceiling was coined by, I think, a management consultant, Marilyn Loden. How do you come across these influences? Like, you read Einstein, Loden, you come across it, and then what sticks? When do you pick up something and transform it into an artwork?
Yes, this is how I start normally my work, is that first I see the problem, like in this case was, okay, how I can make a demonstration, because in fact, for me, they are a kind of demonstrations more than a performance. And I thought, how I can make a demonstration about being against of this glass ceiling. And then I try to imagine how to make a demonstration. The same as with the other works I did with garments. It's all about demonstrations.
And so you just sort of live through the life and with open eyes, and then things come to you, you transform, and others you drop. Like, what's the process on deciding which route to follow?
I must say, I really believe in my intuition.
Okay.
Then, for example, in this case, like many of them, I become obsessive about glass ceiling. Mm-hmm. Then I one moment, my brain makes an image, and I saw the image of these eight women walking with this glass, and then I just do all my best that this happen.
What I really like is that you took this performance of the glass ceiling to a sculptural work. Once upon a time, there was a woman. So when I understand correctly, you took female representation sculptures or sculptures representing women, that's the right term. For example, I think the first sculpture ever was Venus von Willendorf, but there are many others you know better about. And you appropriate them, or you take a replica and then you put a glass ceiling on top. So how did you come to this, and how many variations of female representations are there?
Yes, I am obsessed to look and to find this representation of women in history. Because I think, in fact, that from the beginning already we had a glass ceiling, not from 1978 when this word, you know, the glass ceiling was invented. I think we had a glass ceiling from the beginning. Therefore, I want to maybe to add something very thin and very subtle as a glass ceiling, but I think it's already my expression about how women we were and we are living right now.
But what I think is so interesting also, that these beautiful sculptures are so far away from today's idealized, I don't know, through market, through advertising of how you would imagine female representation.
Yes, yes. I think this is something that of course, I feel as a woman that, you know, advertisement makes a lot of bad things to women. I think I even see in my students or young people around, I think they are slaves of their image.
You did a piece in New York where you somehow left this how would you say, recognizable gender aspect, and became a lost astronaut, because I would say it's pretty gender neutral, no? Because you can't see into the astronaut uniform. What did you do with this? You walked around New York in an astronaut, in an original astronaut outfit, right?
Yes, yes. Was very difficult to find the because it's a real one. You know, the outfit is real. I bought in a museum from a museum. The outfit as an astronaut is a Russian outfit, and from an astronaut. And what happened is that Rosalie Gobler invited me in 2007 for this Performa Biennale in New York, and she came to Spain and she told me, you know, the subject is future. What do you think about the future and women? And I say, oh, it's a good
future
question.
Future and women.
Yes. I thought it was a good question. And of course, she told me already will be connected to the future as, yeah, the future, the space, and maybe the utopian feeling of the future. And then I started to research, and I saw that, in fact, any women went to the moon and I will not go. And then I thought, okay, as a performer, I will love to be a lost astronaut. These women that wanted to go to the moon, but couldn't, because, yeah, women were not allowed to go to the moon.
But I think that, interesting enough, I would have imagined that there were very early female astronauts, no? I mean, there were
yes.
only two men on the moon too, no?
Yes, I think after, of course, other women were astronauts. I must say I was trained as an astronaut because I'm always going very deep in my subject. I work in European Space Agency to study more about astronauts and being a woman and design in the space. And then they took me as an experiment. And they brought me to Utah, and I practiced as an astronaut with other astronauts. And of course, many of them, they were women.
Like in the free fall, right?
Yes. And I was 2 weeks eating food for the space, and we were, I had, it was more like military service, you know, it was very hard. For me, it was very hard to be an astronaut.
It's physically very challenging, no? But
yes.
This was not connected to the project in New York. There you just sort of lived 1 month as an astronaut. Everything you did, groceries,
yes.
You were as an astronaut.
In New York, what I did is I was there for 15 days. I was there for 15 days because it was very hard to be a lost astronaut in New York. And then what I did is I asked like Marina Abramovich and many people living in New York to make the script of the day.
Because then, so they told you what to do.
Yes. Then I did. The only thing I said, I don't want to be naked. The rest, I can do everything you want. But I don't want to put out my outfit. For me, the outfit was very important for the performance. And then, of course, was a way that people that came to visit Performa or New York, they could follow me everywhere, you know, therefore they know what time I have dinner somewhere or what I was doing. And I did for 15 days what other people told me to do.
How did people react to you as an astronaut? Were they scared? Or amused?
Yes. I think New York is a city that that many people talk to me and touch me and wanted to talk and eat with me. And I mean, for me, it was a little too much because, yeah, everybody thought they can just approach me. Was very intense. But at the same time, I love it because I had many reactions. And of course, if I do this work in Helsinki, I'm sure I will feel very lonely astronaut.
Yeah, sure, because, I mean, that's so interesting about New York, that there's so much happening on the street. But now here at the gallery, you, I think it will be a pretty similar situation that you put yourself into the space it's also, how would you say, you let go of barriers, and it's quite vulnerable too, no? Because you sit there, people come, they start a conversation. Eventually, you don't want to have that conversation, but you can't really escape it. It can be good, it can be annoying. So this is part of your, you want that exchange, yeah?
Yes, I think art cannot exist without vulnerability. Therefore, I think as an artist, for me, is very important. I am in the spot of being vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And you're willing to take even uncomfortable confrontations or stupid questions or...
Yes, sure. Yeah. I mean, part of my task will be, yeah, I mean, sometimes the conversations can be, you know, will be difficult or superficial. But, you know, if then in the end of the day, if I can have one conversation with someone that is meaningful, it's already a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean...
Mm-hmm. And how you did this before? How are your experiences?
Oh, yes. I worked many times as a performer in a very dangerous situation. Therefore, I think I have a lot of experience how to deal and how to protect myself at the same time, you know. For example, I was 1 year a dream keeper. You know, I keep the dreams of people. Mm-hmm. People could call me. And the most important is people had to live alone, because it was about loneliness. That is one of my subjects for many years. And then I went to the house of someone at 11 o'clock when this person was alone, almost going to bed. And then, yeah, I think it was a very dangerous situation, because, of course, this person could kill me and I can kill him or her. Therefore, you know, was a situation as a performer that was doesn't exist before, that we were one by one. But, yeah, for me, it's part of my work from the beginning, to be one by one, or to be, you know, in this situation that I really want to escape of, this situation that the artist become a guru or some special figure.
So I think, it's like about equality too.
Yes, yeah, yes. For me, it's very important. For me, it's very important.
And
yes.
And you said you were a dream keeper. Like, how did that work? They told you the dreams, and then you, again, like here, you convert the fears into paintings, or you transformed the screams into cups. What did you do with the dreams?
Yeah, this was in 97. Therefore, was very long time ago. I must say, for me, it's my favorite work of my career. I'm very happy that the Museum of Hirschhorn bought everything of Dreamkeeper, diaries, dress, photos, you know, because I think it's one of the most beautiful work I made. And for 1 year I was dream keeper. Then, for example, yeah, I was an artist in Manifesta or in Esteldi Museum. I had many invitations as an artist, and I say, sorry, but this year I'm dream keeper. Therefore, I can only do this performance. Mm-hmm. And they accepted the challenge. Then people could call. Of course, I had my posters. Of course, it was no Instagram, but I had posters, and people could call the Manifesta, for example. I say, oh, I want dream keeper, come to my house. And then I had an agenda. And then at 11 o'clock, I was going to the house of this person that, of course, I never met before.
But it was important that you went, right? It was not over the telephone.
No, I went there.
You visited the people. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I was alone. With my dress. Yeah. Yes. Because garment always give me a kind of protection and give more understanding of what I go to do. Therefore, I had this dream keeper outfit, and at 11 o'clock I was in the house of this person, and then we talk because I discover, of course, that people are very nervous, even if they like the challenge to have a dream keeper, they are very nervous to have someone they don't know at home
in their private place. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Then I talk, I avoid alcohol, and then after, when the person felt more comfortable, more that he or she could trust me, the person went to bed. Then I stay all night awake, and I made art in their house, you know, in the house of this person, through the conversation we had. Therefore, again, I transform our conversation, our night, no, because in the night I was like 7 hours awake.
And while the person was sleeping, right?
While the person was sleeping, yes.
You stayed during the day or during night?
No, in the night.
In the night. You stayed overnight and did paintings? Or like what was your
outbreak? In this moment, what I did the most of the time was sewing.
Yeah.
Sewing.
Yeah.
In their clothes, uh-huh, or in their curtains, or, you know. And for I did artwork connected to the night.
Okay.
To what I felt in the night.
Yeah. While they were dreaming.
Was sleeping. Yeah. Yes.
And this result was then shown at the museum.
Yes, and then every morning, then the person wake up, and in the moment that the person wake up, I left. And then what I did is with a camera, a mamilla, I put the camera near the person while was sleeping, and I let the diaphragm open all night. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I made a photo that many times was black,
yeah,
or hardly, or sometimes
more
was
abstract,
all moving,
yeah, yeah,
but doesn't matter for me.
Yeah.
I mean, was a kind of very beautiful photos, mm-hmm, I must say. Very beautiful, abstract. And then in the morning, I went to the lab. I developed myself the photo, and I bring to the museum the photo. Therefore, you could see the photo I made in the night.
Somehow the aura of the dream.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And because you talked about your garment and the... So the paintings you choose now are the... How would you say the burlap, the canvas?
Yes.
They are woven. What's the role of here in the exhibition now, where you paint the fears of the visitors? What's the reason for these woven canvases?
Maybe something difficult to understand, but in metaphysics, is some kind of metaphysics that they said sewing. It's a way to heal.
To heal, okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
To reconnect.
Earth.
Yes, yeah.
But in Earth, no, the healing of myself or something. But it's a way of healing. Therefore, mm-hmm, the sewing is a way of healing in
literally fixing, right?
Yeah, fixing, yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I think it's a way of healing.
Great. So it's a good combination of the fear on sort of a healing representing,
yes,
surface or so. Great. Thank you so much for this conversation. I'm looking forward to hear about your conversations you're going to have throughout the entire exhibition. And hope you're going to have a good time and more fruitful conversations than painful ones.
Yes.
Thank you, Alicia.
Thank you. Thank you. Ah, another thing.
Yeah.
We born the same day.
No way.
Yes.
Oh.
22 July.
That's funny because it's the last day of cancer.
Yes.
And my mother always insisted very much, where I'm still a little skeptical, that maybe I'm a Leo and she just wanted to twist it more in the direction to be a... Because, you know, the next day is Leo.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what do you feel? You are Cancer or Leo?
I think pretty much both. Like on the
Me
edge,
too.
I would say.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Me, yeah. And I met two other persons of 22 July and we said the same. That maybe our heart is Cancerian. But we look very much alike.
Exactly. I think,
yes,
we appear to others more like Leos, but inside we are more sensitive and Cancers. But at the same time, that makes it difficult, no? Because people say they don't judge a book by the cover, but in the end they do. And that's why, yeah, be easy on us.
Yes.
Right.